The School of Advanced International Studies. Previously, he has worked for the World Bank. He has also been, he's a professor emeritus at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. And Robert, would you like to come and start our session?
Thanks very much, Paul. It's a real pleasure to be back up in Canada. I grew up about a two-hour drive southwest of Dorval Airport, an hour and a quarter south of Ottawa, and just on the New York State Bank of the St. Lawrence River. So I grew up on a diet of CBC television and often knew more about what was going on in Canada, Canadian politics, than in the U.S. But at the moment, we're living in Washington, D.C., and appreciate the chance to come up and talk about the role of trade and food security. When we're talking about trade, we certainly have to start out with the reality of the globalization of agriculture, that this really truly is a global business. The fraction of world agriculture production moving through trade is growing. The fraction that flows in value-added form is increasing faster than bulk commodities. And with global supply chains, it means that more and more of the trade is occurring within firms rather than among firms. I'm not going to speak specifically to the food safety aspects. Other speakers will handle that. But the development of global supply chains certainly has had implications for food safety, as when companies confront the reality of standards being so different in so many different countries, the private company standards are often superseding national standards as companies insist that they that all of their suppliers, no matter where they are in the world, adhere to what are often quite a bit higher standards than specific countries. When we're talking about international trade and food security, I think it is important to remind ourselves of the strategic importance of food. And when we're looking at issue of what is strategic, I went back and looked in the dictionary, and most of the definitions are mainly military in orientation, but the one I liked was that from an individual country's perspective, something is strategic if it's essential for that country to sustain its economic, political, and or military power. And this clearly puts food in the status of being a strategic good, because every country has to ensure that there's a reliable, safe and nutritious, reasonably priced supply of food from some combination of both domestic production and imports. But we should remind ourselves that it's neither economically efficient nor environmentally sustainable for every country to try to be self-sufficient in all foods. It simply leads to huge resource waste and also unsustainable production if the country attempts to do that. But to discuss food security, we really need to address it in three different dimensions: at the household level, the national level, and the global level. And at the household level, food insecurity is principally driven by lack of purchasing power. In fact, FAO defines the number of people who are hungry as the number of people who don't have enough purchasing power to access 1,800 calories per capita per day. And it's important to talk about purchasing power, not just poverty, because the poor spend such a large fraction of their income on food. The rich in no country go hungry except in times of war, natural disaster, or politically imposed famine. So if we're going to overcome food insecurity, we do have to worry about both access as well as availability of food products. If we're going to solve the hunger problem, we have to solve the poverty problem. And 70% of that extreme poverty is in rural areas, and a large fraction of these people are net food buyers, not net food sellers. So we can use food aid for emergency feeding needs. I think there will always be a need for food aid for emergency feeding, but we ought to aspire to a world in which no country is a chronic food aid recipient, as several countries in Africa are today. National food security, then, deals with the what is the potential of any given country for self-sufficiency that's both economically efficient and environmentally sustainable? But if a country is going to rely on the international market for a significant part of its national food security, it's got to be able to sell something in the world market in which it has a comparative advantage. And sadly, we in the high-income world tend to be most protectionist in many of the same products in which low-income countries have a comparative advantage, such as labor-intensive manufacturers, footwear, textiles, agricultural commodities that do well in the tropics, such as sugarcane, cotton, rice. But trade has to play an important role in ensuring the national food security of individual countries. At the global level, which we'll talk briefly about, we're basically dealing with what is the potential for the world's farmers to produce 70% or whatever the number is, more food in the next 40 years, and do it in a manner which is environmentally sustainable, but also delivers that food at reasonable cost to consumers. And we'll return briefly to that issue near the end of my presentation. But at the national level, one of the biggest problems in the developing countries today that's resulted in so many countries being chronic food aid recipients is that between 1980 and 2005, foreign aid to developing countries for agriculture development dropped precipitously. In 1980, foreign aid donors around the world were donating about $8 billion a year to agricultural development. 17% of their total. This dropped to 3% of the whole in the course of 25 years. And the fraction that was going to agriculture research, to do the adaptive research to increase productivity in agriculture in low-income countries, the fraction going to agriculture research dropped more than proportionately. So just for example, in the United States in the 1980s, we were giving 25% of our foreign aid for agriculture and rural development. We recognized that with the majority of the poverty is in rural areas, we had to focus more resources on rural development and agriculture. But by 2009, the U.S. was down to less than 1% of its foreign aid going to rural development and agriculture. The World Bank lending for ag dropped similarly. We've since the L'Aquila summit, we've had a slight increase. But it's that the money we're investing in agricultural development in U.S. foreign aid is extremely tenuous at the moment in the current budget environment, a very high risk that that will disappear. But again, if we're serious about developing countries, reducing poverty where the majority is in rural areas, and being able to satisfy more of their food needs through domestic production, we've got to redouble our commitments to foreign aid going to agriculture and rural development. There's an objective in low-income countries in sub-Saharan Africa, in the so-called Maputo Declaration, for governments in sub-Saharan Africa to get the investments in agriculture and rural development back up to 10% of their national budgets. It would be a good move if we were able to get the same thing in our foreign aid programs, but we're far from it at the moment. It was mentioned earlier session that yields are extremely low relative in many of the low-income parts of the world. This is one of the reasons that that we see such large food aid needs in a number of countries and chronic food aid needs. This is a map that was developed up at the University of Wisconsin based on satellite imagery as well as the statistics on crop yields around, or cereal grain yields around the world. And as we see here, the dark blue is the lowest yield, often a third to a half the world average. So the light green is about the world average yield for wheat, rice, and maize. The yellow is upwards of twice the world average, and red is the higher, up at the right hand end, this is the highest yields per hectare. And as we see, there's a huge yield gap, some of which obviously is attributable to climatic conditions, but a significant amount to the underinvestment in agriculture research, the lack of fertilizer use that Amit Rai talked about earlier this morning, and basically to inattention to agriculture and rural development in many parts of the low-income world. Certainly, developing countries' own policies have had an important influence and been an important impediment to their agricultural development. The list is familiar: corruption, lack of property rights, lack of enforcement of contracts, underinvestment in rural public goods such as infrastructure, education, research, and development. These are some of the core areas where foreign aid and lending to the World Bank could make a huge difference. But of course, a lot of the governments in low-income countries have also turned the terms of trade against their farmers to protect urban consumers. Overall, the lack of technology adapted to the local agroecological conditions is a critical shortcoming. But picking up on the resource discussion in the previous session, on this chart, I have plotted on the right-hand side the percentage distribution of population around the world, and the left, the percentage distribution of arable land. And I'd like to focus your attention on the dark red wedge on the right and the pink wedge on the left, which are East Asia and South Asia, respectively. And the takeaway point is that these two regions have twice as much of the world's population than of the arable land. And, of course, this is one of the factors that's driving the land grabs that were discussed also in the previous session. Middle East and North Africa have comparable percentages of land and population, but of course they lack water. But it's difficult for me, with the population and economic growth as well as urbanization rates going on in these regions, to come up with any scenario in which East Asia, South Asia, or Africa, North Africa and the Middle East won't end up being significantly larger net importers of food, whether they're growing it on land that they own in other countries or just buying it from the world market. Adding to this, with global climate change going on, certainly adaptive plant and animal breeding can help. Some regions will have to change the mix of what crops they're producing in a given location. But I think this too, in addition to the different distribution of land and population, climate change also will cause more of the world's agriculture production to move through international markets. So putting all this together, what are the long-term prospects? Well, since the time of Malthus, we've had lots of prophets of doom who predicted that population growth will increase demand for food faster than agricultural production can grow. But what Malthus did not anticipate is that public and private investments in agriculture research increased productivity faster than that demand grew, and we had a 150-year decline in the real price of cereal grains after taking out the effect of inflation up to about 2008. But now we need a big increase in world food production, perhaps 70 or 80%, using in all likelihood less water due to the urbanization outbidding farmers for available water, and little more land than today, and it appears will also, with current petroleum prices, be producing some biofuel feedstocks from agriculture as well. So the issue with respect to long-term price is that the future world market price trend will depend on whether we invest enough in agriculture research to raise land and water productivity faster than global demand grows. Unfortunately, the trend has been in the wrong direction in investments in agriculture research, which would lead me to anticipate similar to Mark's presentation in the previous session, we're probably in for a world in which we have an upward trend rather than a downward trend in long-term commodities. My last slide, then, is anticipating a world of greater agricultural trade. Because the arable land and water are not distributed around the world in the same proportions as population, because agriculture continues to underperform relative to its potential in many low-income countries, although the disincentives are declining. But with population growth and broad-based economic development in low-income countries, growth in their food demand is likely to outstrip production potential, and more of the world's agriculture production will move through international markets. Now, if we have greater trading export opportunities for low-income countries, it would accelerate their economic growth, but this would also accelerate growth in their own food consumption and also growth in their commercial import opportunities. But one thing we do need to try to achieve is a world in which we have a ban on agricultural export embargoes, because as we saw in 2008, price spike, a significant part of that increase in price was associated with policy decisions taken by low-income governments or low-income country governments themselves, including the restrictions and outright embargoes on agricultural exports. Thanks very much for having me.